Support for this public radio podcast comes from Bose, offering Bose in-ear headphones designed for comfort and quality sound and featuring soft silicone tips in three sizes at bose.com/radio.
Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com.
You know, there's only one time my wife has let out a blood-curdling scream right into my face, so far anyway. This happened when I came up the basement stairs wearing this long, blonde, Andy Gibb-looking wig I used to wear when I played saxophone in a 70s cover band. That's right. I thought I was being funny. I thought I was being clever. She thought I was some kind of Andy Gibb-looking hoodlum who'd been waiting in the basement for just the right moment to sneak up the stairs and slit her throat. Suffice it to say, costumes are no longer a part of this active, healthy marriage. I'm Jeff Horwich, and disguise is the theme tonight for our latest In the Loop Story Slam. The Story Slam is an occasional version of In the Loop where we take our commitment to our audience to the extreme. Here's how it works. I'm on stage right now at the snazzy Suburban World Theater in Minneapolis. We've got stars twinkling on the ceiling. Big bar right in the middle of the room. This place is pretty unique. Next to me is an open microphone. And for the last hour, people have been signing up to give us their best stories on our theme. As soon as I'm done talking here, we'll start pulling names and getting people up here on stage with me. We've got no idea what stories are coming. This show, the way we do it, is unplanned and very unpredictable. Storytellers, here's a little bit of guidance for you. You gotta sell it when you tell it. I'm gonna rhyme everything because it's more fun that way. Make these people listening love you or loathe you. Either way, you gotta make them care. I've said it before, this is our little story slam mantra, right? Slam it, damn it. Our theme tonight is disguise. Thank you to the Woo guy and back. We're recording this on the cusp of Halloween, as it turns out. Audience, why don't you let our storytellers know you're there? Give us your best blood-curdling scream, if you will. Curdled my blood even more than when my wife did it right into my face. Our In the Loop house band, The Smarts, is ready to improvise their way through the evening. Whether you're with us by radio, podcast, or here at the beautiful Suburban World Theater in Minneapolis, thanks for joining us for this In the Loop Story Slam. All right, let's not waste any time. Let's get our first storyteller right up here for the Story Slam. This is Nancy Donoval. Now, you had a big day.
I did have a big day today.
You got published for the first time,
right?
What a great crowd.
I just got the book in the mail today.
Very nice. So what's the subject of your book?
It's not my book. It's a collection of stories called The Scenic Route, Stories from the Heartland. And it was published by Indiana Historical Society. So I have one of my stories in there.
Oh, congratulations. Along with that first, we got fingerprinted today for the first time.
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with, was that a requirement for publishing your story in the book? Or?
No, I went to an orientation to be a substitute teacher in the Minneapolis school system today. So
you
get fingerprinted, and it was my first time. It was very exciting.
Nancy Donoval, thanks for being here. Our theme tonight, of course, disguise, and give us your best.
I grew up a dyed-in-the-wool goody-two-shoes. Whenever my friends and I would set out on an adventure, I was the one who could be counted on to say, "You guys, I don't think this is a very good idea. We might get in trouble." But then one night, when I was 20, I went looking for trouble. And I didn't go alone. I went with two of my cohorts. We were all in the theater department of a Jesuit university in Wisconsin. And we were all in the same play together. We were doing a production of Ah, Wilderness by Eugene O'Neill. But it wasn't O'Neill that made this more than a college play. It was the fact that it was being directed by a guest director from New York. I don't know if you can know how impressive the words New York are unless you are going to a Catholic university in Wisconsin. But when we found out he was going to come and direct that play, we knew we had to get into that play, and we did. Barb ended up being the mom of the family, and Michelle, she ended up being the pretty ingenue, and I took my role in life as the wacky spinster aunt. When he came and started the rehearsals, we worshipped him. This was the man who was going to take us across the threshold from doing school plays to creating art. But then the worship got to be a heavy burden. When you look up to someone so much, or look down as the case might be, he was 5'2". When someone has that much power, you start to get antsy. And we started to get sick of him treating us like little Catholic schoolgirls, even though we were indeed little Catholic schoolgirls. He would flirt. He would say, "Oh, you know, I have nothing to do but work on this play 24 hours a day. If you have a question about your character, you can come to my hotel room. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll be there." Right. We're all going to show up. Mostly he flirted with Michelle, ingenue, Michelle, whose nickname was Fluff, Michelle, who had an Italian fiancé and the most incredible collection of Italian shoes we'd ever seen. He'd say, "Michelle, are you coming tonight?" And she'd say, "Tonight, I'll be there tonight." And the next day he'd say, "Michelle, you weren't there. What are you, all talk and no action?" Yeah. We decided that was it. We were calling his bluff. He couldn't be the only one to have power. We were going to go down to his hotel room. After our last tech rehearsal, we were going to go to his hotel room and ring his doorbell and then we'd see. But we couldn't do it as ourselves because we were actresses. We were used to getting into character, and none of our characters held the ability to go do this. So we had to find a way to become wild. We got into the costume storage room. Michelle picked out a black and pink lace dress with matching black and pink lace shoes. Barb had a filmy, gauzy, form-fitting figure that made her look like a buxom Marilyn Monroe. I had a subdued little red velvet ball gown, strapless with a white net underskirt. And we thought the clothes would be enough. We thought the clothes would give us the power to go, but they didn't. They didn't. We weren't wild enough. We ended up back at Michelle's apartment, and Frank came over. Frank was our connection. Frank brought an herbal supplement to help us. But as a well-trained goody-two-shoes, I couldn't smoke the supplement. I had asthma. I couldn't inhale. So Michelle got a container of sour cream, and we mixed the herb up in it and ate it with potato chips. And it wasn't until years later when I was telling a friend about this, and he said, "Nancy, you have to cook it. That's why people smoke it. That's why they bake it in brownies." And I thought, oh, that explains a lot. Because there we were, overdressed and slightly nauseous. And still not wild. And then it came to us. We knew what we had to do. We had to gather the personas of the 70s icons, because this was 1981. This was the time of Charlie's Angels. We went into Michelle's kitchen. We got out kitchen utensils. We got out wooden spoons. We got out spatulas. We got out egg beaters. And then we took the pose, the silhouette that always opened the show, and we held out our kitchen utensils and practiced yelling, "Freeze, freeze, freeze." And somehow, that did it. Somehow, being Charlie's Angels, pulling on the mask of their feminine Barbie doll but still carrying gun personas, put us into the car with Frank, our own personal Bosley. He drove us down to that hotel. We went up to the door. We rang the bell. And what happened when he opened it? Well, I guess that's another story.
Nancy Donabal, leaving us hanging. That's our house band, The Smarts, coming up with music as we go, by the way. They are listening to these stories very carefully. Our theme tonight for the Story Slam, Disguise, and we're at the Suburban World Theater in Minneapolis. I've got a new face up here, someone I haven't met before to Story Slam, Lane McKiernan. How you doing, Lane?
All right.
Thanks for coming down. Now, this is a fine how do you do. Nice way to get to know you. The thing on my little card here, it says, Lane McKiernan is paid to pick up poop.
Yes, because I take care of other people's dogs.
Well, that sounds lovely.
It is.
Picking up poop is that not the most glamorous part of that job,
I suppose. But I also don't have to talk to people if I don't want to.
Yeah, you save all that up for stepping in front of 300 of us here at the,
yeah.
at the Story Slam. Well, we're glad to have you. Very nice to meet you. And let's hear your story.
Thank you. There were three of us. Shaved heads, leather jackets, button-down shirts, combat boots. Two James Dean Henry Wallens wannabes and me. Doing my best not to look like somebody's tag-along little sister. It was boys' night. We were walking down Nicollet Avenue. We went every Wednesday from John's apartment near the post office to the dark, dark little bar. We were the dorks, but we were trying not to be the dorks because we were guys. We hadn't started out as guys, but now we're guys. And so here we were, walking down Nicollet Avenue, practicing our swagger. Joe was good at his swagger. Frank invented the swagger, and I had been listening to them lecture me about my lack of swagger for the last month, practicing. We were practicing, I was practicing. And so here we were, walking down Nicollet Avenue, and I was spending so much time and attention trying to keep my feet in the right place so that my ass would not swing back and forth like a flag that I didn't see the curb until I tripped over it and flipped over and landed in the middle of the intersection in front of a VW. So Joe and Frank come and they grab me up by the elbows and they plop me on the other side of the intersection. And Joe says, "What was that?" "That was not a swagger." I don't know what that was. I was staring at my feet, trying to pretend that I wasn't there, that it hadn't happened, that maybe I had aliens for relatives, and they would come and get me, and I could pretend this had never happened. Or they could, you know, turn me into what I felt I was, a man, and I wouldn't have to go through this process of becoming one, of, yeah, it wasn't working. Frank, he was good. Frank turns to me and he says, "You know, this swagger thing is not working for you. Perhaps that is not the kind of man that you're supposed to be. Let's try something else. Let's see. Why don't you spit for me? Spit. Spit like a man." Thank you.
Lane McKiernan. All right, got our next Story Slammer up here on stage next to me. This guy was a great surprise for us at our last Story Slam, and we asked if he'd be willing to come back tonight and give it another shot. Matt Pikin. Matt, thanks for coming.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Matt.
Thank you.
The Matt Pikin fan club in attendance. Matt was a reporter until fairly recently at the Pioneer Press. We were asking you about your transition out of that, and you said, actually, since you left the news business, you don't even follow the news anymore?
I didn't for a while. In fact, I was intentional about it. I didn't want to look at the newspaper or, with all due respect to NPR, I wasn't listening to the radio much, and I just glued myself to my iPod and listened to music, and my news was pretty much delivered by Nine Inch Nails, Rob Zombie, Tool, you know, the progenitors of current events.
And did you find yourself pulled back, though, eventually? It sounds like it was a temporary
thing. Yeah, I did. You know, when I started forgetting what day of the week it was, and I literally was forgetting. I wouldn't know, you know, whether it was Tuesday or Thursday, which is why I agreed to show up tonight on a Wednesday, because I wasn't paying attention. Now that I'm a little more glued, I'm wondering why I chose to do this tonight.
Why you would waste a Wednesday night on
exactly.
us? Exactly. I guess so. We're about to find out. This is Matt Pikin. Matt, give us your take on Disguise.
Thanks. As Jeff said, this year marked my 10th anniversary, actually, as a staff writer at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and I was pretty miserable for quite a while. So this past July, I told a friend over lunch that if the paper ever offered another buyout, that's where they actually pay you to leave the paper, that I would leap at it. Well, 3 hours later, the paper announced more buyouts. I couldn't help but see the serendipity in that, so I take the buyout. Now, some people who've taken buyouts go to law school, some go into PR. What I really want to do at this point is deal poker. It's true, I love the game, but really, I want to write stories about the people I would meet at the tables. But my challenge here is disguising my real intent. See, there's no way casinos will hire me if they know I'm only trying to gather material for a book. The question is, how do I hide the past 20 years of my life as a writer on my resume? And then I hit upon an idea. To lead with the jobs I'd never thought I'd again have to divulge on a job application. June 1978, I enter America's workforce through the front door of a Winchell's Donuts, where I'm soon shown the door for burning a coworker with donut grease. June 1978, I wash dishes at Sambo's restaurant and am laid off 3 weeks later for trying to form a union. 1979, I'm fired from a job delivering flowers because of reckless driving. I even serve time. 3 hours in a concrete holding cell for possession of a street sign. Sure enough, I get a call a couple days later from Treasure Island Resort and Casino. You know, calypso music, steel drums, the island Fantasia. Now, they want me to come in for an interview, and the drive to Treasure Island is lined with the scenery one expects along the way to an exotic island, just as seagulls cry off the coast of Red Wing, Minnesota. In fact, Treasure Island takes its name from two sources: the life-changing treasures awaiting within, and the neighboring Prairie Island nuclear power plant, whose organic glow renders all external casino lighting superfluous. The waiting room of the Human Resources office is adorned with posters from the true giants of show business: Vicki Lawrence, a Beatles tribute band, and the surviving members of Blue Oyster Cult. Vicki signed her poster, "Thanks for the memories." And I'm wondering what fond memories Vicki took away from here when the receptionist hands me a piece of paper and a pencil. "This is the math test," she says. "You have 20 minutes. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I say the average fourth grader could ace this test. There are 50 questions here, all illustrated with playing cards, like King plus 3 plus 4 equals what? I finish the test in just over 4 minutes and hand it back. "Done already?" she says. "Sure you don't want to double check?" Nah. And to my everlasting embarrassment, I actually miss one question. But I'm led to a small office where I'm met by the casino's pit boss, who oversees all the dealers. Now, he's about my height, with dark, thinning, slicked back hair, a brown suit, and a body shaped like an eggplant. And I learned right off the bat that they expect me to work every weekend and holiday. I ask if that includes Rosh Hashanah, and the pit boss shakes his head. "No, we don't observe tribal holidays." They tell me I'll start with 3 weeks of unpaid training, then move directly onto the gaming floor. I'll work 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. every Friday and Saturday night, and at least one midweek night. The starting pay, $5 an hour. I know, smoking. Now, before I could pick my jaw up from the floor, the pit boss chuckles. "Yeah, it looks better and better, doesn't it? But you know, you make your money through tips." Okay, so my eyes brighten up a little bit, and I ask how much that is, and he clears his throat. "Well, let's just put it this way. Nobody's ever complained about making enough money here." "So, really? Well, how much is that?" And kind of looks askance. He says, "Well, if you play it well, you're a good dealer, you work real hard, you could make $30,000 a year here." And I say, okay, well, that's not bad for 3 nights a week. And he goes, oh, no, that's full time. He also says I have to start on the blackjack tables, and it could take months and maybe years to work my way up to the poker tables. And finally, he asked the question I fear the most. Why do I want to stop being a writer? And it occurs to me I really can't bluff my way out of this one. I tell him, you know, I'm always going to be a writer, but I just don't want to work for newspapers anymore. And it dawns on me at that moment that that's entirely true. The business I hungered to be a part of more than 20 years ago just no longer exists. And I tell him, in all honesty, that the business doesn't seem to want someone like me anymore either. So I go home, certain I'll soon be wearing Jimmy Buffett's best wear. And the letter from Treasure Island arrives the following week. We regret to inform you that your qualifications do not meet our present needs. I often play poker at Canterbury Park in Shakopee, and I look at the dealers now with just a little more reverence and respect. They passed the test. They worked up to where they are now, and their tip boxes always look full to me. If my book is meant to happen, it will start by studying the faces of these dealers, because they always seem to tell me stories without my having to ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt Pikin. This is the In the Loop Story Slam. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I was thinking about our theme tonight, disguise, and I was thinking about what I do for a living, or what I have done for a living, at least, as a reporter for a number of years. Kind of struck me that that's kind of a process of going into and out of disguise every single day, in a way. I mean, at times you're trying to sort of disguise your allegiances or your feelings or whatever, right? I'm thinking of times when, you know, I need to go watch Passion of the Christ, for example, for an assignment that I have to do. And not my crowd, normally, but you need to slip in there and enjoy it and understand the experience for what it is. Also, times out doing a story about a white power music label, one of those times when I really totally felt like I needed to be in disguise in order to kind of have this conversation. As a journalist, just one of those things. Also, like, if I'm going into classrooms, you gotta kind of disguise yourself a little bit as a kid. I had to do a story about strip clubs, a number of stories about strip clubs in central Minnesota for a while, so I had to disguise myself as an enthusiastic strip club patron, which is very difficult to do, let me tell you. Around that time, I was also hanging out, story about drunk driving in rural areas, and I needed to spend a couple of late evenings on the weekends out at these rural bars in Minnesota, which also not necessarily my crowd. But it's funny how when you slip into a disguise like that, you start to feel it. I mean, in a way, almost anybody can be your crowd. You just need to kind of force yourself to get into that mode. Speaking of people who disguise themselves for a living, I'm told that our next storyteller, Laura Bidgood, says you also are in disguise every day because of what you do for a living.
I do. Well, I recently got a job where I work downtown now. And I actually have to dress up every day. So it's a completely different environment for me because I have to wear like high heels and a skirt. Who doesn't like that? Me, that's who doesn't like it. So so every day I feel like I'm pretending to be a grown-up. So
anyway, Laura Bidgood, mm-hmm. Thanks for coming out to the Story Slam.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you for the first time.
Thanks.
And let us have it.
All right. It's 1985. I am 7 years old and in second grade at Robert Miller Place Elementary School in Bismarck, North Dakota. My teacher, Mrs. McCallum, is about to make a very important announcement to the class. The theme for this year's school pageant is an ode to Lawrence Welk. Shrieks and twitters of excitement spill forth from the entire class. The loudest and most incoherent come from me because I love school pageant the most. Mrs. McCallum goes on to say that the entire class will make up the chorus, but then we'll have a chance to audition to be a singer, an actor, or a dancer in the school pageant. My ears instantly perk up at the word dance. I know what I want to do for this year's school pageant. I want to be a dancer. Now, I've never really danced before, but in my mind, not only am I the best dancer that the school has ever seen, but I am the best dancer that the world has ever seen. Exclamation point. The next day at auditions, I break to everyone I can see about what a good dancer I am and how I am sure to be picked as a dancer in the school pageant. Now, during auditions, I sing like nobody's listening. You oughta go to North Dakota, see the cattle and the wheat and the folks that can't be beat. And I dance like nobody's watching. And even though I don't quite get the steps, I make direct eye contact at Mrs. McCallum and I smile as big as I can. When it comes to the acting part of the audition, I act with as much emotion as I can muster. Now, my mother once described someone who can sing and dance as well as act as a triple threat. And I remember this term as I leave the audition. Triple threat indeed, I landed it. Robert Miller Place Elementary School, Laura Bidgood, the triple threat, has just left the building. The next day, I push and shove my way in front of the crowd gathered at the cast list, fully expecting to see Laura Bidgood, .. dancer at the top of the list. I'm dismayed to see at the very bottom of the list, Laura Bidgood, .. bubble blower. What? Now, for those of you who have seen the Lawrence Welk show, now give it up if you have. Lawrence Welk was known for his famous champagne bubbles that would magically appear whenever the Lawrence Welk band played. Now, bubble blower was probably a fine part if you were not a talented performer like myself. I was a triple threat, remember? I decide to make sure that Mrs. McCallum has not made a mistake. Mrs. McCallum, I'm a dancer. Well, Laura, Mrs. McCallum says, there were so many talented people at auditions that it was hard to decide who was going to do what. Now, you have such a bubbly personality that we thought you would be the perfect bubble blower. Maybe I should not have told everyone that I was going to be a dancer until I actually got the part. Did I just stumble across a life lesson? Rehearsals for the pageant start, and even though no one asks me to, I secretly learn all the dances just in case someone gets sick and they need a fill-in. Now, I may just be a bubble blower in that pageant, but I am still a dancer. And you know what? Mrs. McCallum cannot take that away from me! Well, actually, she kinda did. Well, still, you know what? I've got spirit, and I'm not a quitter, and I'm gonna do the best job I can. So what if I'm not a dancer? So what if I'm not center stage, or even on the stage? Mrs. McCallum decides that she wants the bubbles to magically appear, so she sticks me behind the bleachers that the chorus is standing on. Well, you know what? I'm gonna do the best job I can. At the end of the night, I blow those bubbles, and you know what? They look great.
That's Laura Bidgood, everybody. If old Mrs. McCallum could see her now, right? Thanks, Laura. That's the smarts you're listening to here on the Story Slam. Now, when we do this, we always like to turn our band loose on the topic as well, and now is the time that we're going to do that. Joe Weissman, bass player and lyricist, what do you got for us tonight on the subject of disguise?
Well, this is a song that we wrote actually specifically for the occasion. It's a song about a couple in the death throes of a relationship unhappily attending a costume party together. May or may not be based on a true story of any sort. It's called I Don't Recognize You. One, two, three, four. Doo-doo-doo.
favorite gum and false mustache. I laid down a lot of cash for this getup. No more chips, I'm all fed up. You get drunk and I get mad. Just how many have you had? Can we go now? Tired of people I don't know now. Another battle to be fought. We're all made up, but we're not. There's something I should mention. Now that you've got everyone's attention, that's a nice disguise. I hope you win the prize. And I feel like I don't recognize you anymore. Plastic sword and plastic sheath. When I talk, you grit your teeth. That's a nice touch. Tell me, does that wig itch much? When is this thing gonna end? Where did you get all these friends? What a hit you're making. Not the only act you're faking. Another battle to be fought. We're all made up, but we're not. There's something I should mention. Now that you've got everyone's attention, that's a nice disguise. I hope you win the prize. And I feel like I don't recognize you anymore. Recognize you anymore. Recognize you.
Thanks, guys. Let's keep the story slam rolling with Dave Mondi. Dave, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dave's one of our favorites, and glad to have him back to take on Disguise. We are recording this show with Halloween just around the corner. What do you get planned for Halloween, Dave?
I am actually, through my acting agency, I have to go as part of the Wizard of Oz and hand out candy at Mystic Lake Casino.
Really? Yes. To gambling people?
Yeah, I imagine. Or people that love buffets. One of the two, I imagine.
Not children, I suppose.
And they said I would be perfect for the Scarecrow, which I'm trying to, you know, not take as an insult. So,
why the Wizard of Oz at a casino?
I don't know. Maybe because it should, like, blow away or something. I have no idea. But
they do have little tiny men kind of behind curtains working various levers, I suppose.
Yes, they do.
So there's a connection there. Anyway, Dave Mondi, give us your best. Thanks a lot.
40 pounds of plush fur. This was my girlfriend's work uniform. No, she did not work in a profession you'd see profiled on a late-night HBO documentary. Rather, she worked as a costumed character at a theme park. And I don't want to say specifically what theme park, because she's in costume and all these kids are, you know, hugging her and whatever. And then when they walk away, she turns to me and opens her arms, right? So I hug Snoopy. And then I did this thing. I made sure no kids could see me, but I grabbed her ass and whispered, "Looking good." I didn't whisper in her ear, I whispered it in Snoopy's mouth because I was the only mesh opening, but you get the idea. Now, I did this because, okay, I knew she would think it was funny, first of all, and second of all, it's one of those things like, how often are you going to get the chance to grope a major American cartoon character? Gotta go for it. So her handler leads her away, and I'm waiting for her to get done and come out, and I'm waiting, and eventually I take out my cell phone to find this message from her. Just pick me up at my place. They don't need me at work tonight. I didn't just grope a major American cartoon character. I sexually harassed a major American cartoon character. Although I will always contend that he was asking for it. Look at what he is wearing. Nothing. I'm just shaking. I can't be responsible for myself with that out there. So I call her, and of course it turned out she was just playing a joke on me. You know, she was actually in the costume, because life is not actually like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Everything was fine, but I'm telling you, it was a tense couple of moments there, because also at this time I was employed as a daycare teacher. You don't want that on your record, fondling Snoopy when you're applying for a daycare job. I was a very good daycare teacher. But what I really wanted to be was a writer, like a wandering writer who rambled the countryside Kerouac-like, recording all his romantic travails. Yes, thank you. And I told myself I couldn't do this because of my girlfriend, you know. But that was really just a convenient excuse, so I didn't have to face the fact that the truth was I didn't have the courage, okay? I had tried writing and mostly failed. I didn't know yet that that was like 90% of what any writing is. So I gave up. And, you know, I told myself caring for kids is more important than writing anyways. This is who you are. Be fine with it. I thought I was doing a good job at that. But I had this odd late night habit. Not that one. But when I would get depressed, I would sometimes get in my car and I would drive the 494-694 loop for hours. And I would smoke a cigarette and blast some good driving road trip music. Yeah, and I would imagine that I was on a road trip, right? And then I would, whenever I saw some obscure exit, I would take it, drive until I found a hotel bar, go inside, and I could be anybody. Now, no one ever really talked to me all that much, except for this one place that I went back to twice in 1 week, because the waitress there was friendly and, equally important, let's be honest, attractive. And I always had my laptop with me, like, tapping away on some, you know, great text or whatever, you know. And eventually she asked me, you know, what are you always working so hard on? And I said, well, this story about New Orleans. This was true. But then she said, oh, is that what you do? And I said, yes, I'm a travel writer. The bar ended up sending me over some shots, you know, because they want to be reviewed well. You know, I stayed till they closed down at midnight, and then when she got off her shift, I'm sharing a cigarette with her, and she says, you know, I'm meeting some friends later. You know, would you like to join me? And I really wanted to. Thankfully, for the sake of fidelity to myself as much as to my girlfriend, I lied again and said, I can't, I'm on a deadline. But, you know, maybe I can catch you the next time I'm in town. And I went up the elevators to my room and then snuck down the back stairs and, you know, left. And in my car, you know, I was feeling really, like, embarrassed and ashamed. But then I thought, you know, if that's what you're going to pretend to be, maybe that's what you should actually try to be. It was like the old sci-fi story where the man finds the magical mask which, once donned, melds to his face until eventually it gets to the point where you can't really tell the difference between the man and the disguise. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave Mondi. It's the Story Slam from In the Loop, and I'm Jeff Horwich. Our next Story Slammer, Michelle Lyons. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
What was the worst costume that you have ever had to wear? As we're talking right now, we've got Halloween around the corner, so what's your worst memory there?
The worst costume I ever wore, I was 12 years old, and I was McGruff, the crime-fighting dog, in a pageant in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
What's so rough about McGruff?
Well, it turns out that taking a bite out of crime means that you have to wear a trench coat and long pants in 106 degree heat, But the best part about the whole costume was that there was a fan inside the nose, and I could turn it on and off while I was wearing it so that I didn't get overheated, except it was like inside the nose, so I had to like pick McGruff's nose to turn this fan on and off, and I couldn't do it in front of anybody or any children because they would see McGruff picking his nose.
Or at least you didn't have Dave Mondy around grabbing your butt.
That would have been a bad place for it as well.
Michelle Lyons, our next story slammer. Thanks for being here.
The daily aspects of my life have changed drastically since I began working at an aquarium. My comparative religion degree didn't exactly prepare me for the ever-present task of counting sharks to make sure they didn't get eaten. Now I'm back in school, about to finish a degree in design, and hoping to hell the job search will be a little easier this time around. I'm certainly hoping that this time around I'll get to be a little more honest with the objective line of my resume. Objective: to make enough money to live. Which is not what happens at the aquarium. Objective: to make my grandmother proud without getting married. Objective: to play free cell at least 2 hours a day. My biggest objective at this point would probably be to stop counting sharks, but at least I don't have to be the mascot.
Michelle Lyons. Our theme tonight is disguise. Kurt Lund is the next story slammer to take a whack at it. How you doing, Kurt?
All right.
Kurt says here that you recently quit your corporate job.
Sure.
My people. Yes.
How awful was your corporate job, Kurt?
It was pretty awful. It was archetypically awful. And now everything is like a Gary Marshall movie. It's just magical. It's wonderful.
Details, if you would, your corporate job. What was so nightmarish about it?
I'd prefer not. I think he listens to NPR.
Okay. And he and we've announced your name, so. All right. Kurt Lund, let's hear your story.
How young is too young for a toupee? This is the question I asked myself as I sat alone with my grandfather in a small room off the main nave of his church. I can't recall ever having been alone in a room with him before. I guess this probably doesn't count anyway. He is dead, after all. My small immediate family is out taking care of crises involving parking and potato salad, this being a German funeral mass, which left me alone to go over the Bible readings I was about to impart and reflect upon the genetics that had led to my premature receding hairline, which just then was reflecting back at me off my grandfather's own shiny pate. The Irish and the Italians usually get all the credit for over-the-top Catholicism, but we Germans can dish it out pretty thick, too. Two words: polka mass. My grandfather, patriarch of the Central North Dakota branch of the family, took it upon himself to provide our own channel to the Pope. The man wanted desperately for me to become a priest. My mom and aunt were his only children, so he had no sons to groom for the seminary. And by my confirmation at age 13, I had achieved the status of eldest grandson without a police record. But for this greatest of great expectations, I suspect I would have already been written off by my grandfather. At family gatherings, I had always preferred the company of the women in the kitchen over the living room's televised sports and crushing of beer cans on various parts of one's body. I didn't judge, but I did avoid. From the living room, I heard time and again what I would come to consider my grandfather's catchphrase: "I've got no time for sissies." The object of his exclamation varied, but what typically set him off was seeing men, usually on TV, fussing with their hair. Nothing sissified a man in my grandpa's eyes like a well-done do. I always suspected he was overcompensating, his anger disguising a deep jealousy of any man with a head full of flowing Patrick Swayze-like tresses. I judged by old photographs that he had lost any hope for a shag or man bob by probably around the age I was then. My other three grandparents were the slow downhill slope type, childhood memories mainly of hospitals and nursing homes and darkened rooms, perpetually sick. I don't know which was harder on my parents, the perpetual hanging on by threads or the rapid downward spiral of dementia that pulled my grandfather back in time. I was away at college before it hit full force. One winter, back for Christmas break, I announced that I'd been accepted to spend a semester traveling and studying abroad in Italy, and he replied, "Aren't they the enemy?" He did have his moments of lucidity, and it was in one of these moments when he made his dying wish. He realized he was not long for this world, and he asked my aunt to promise he would be buried in a toupee. With 11 siblings, this would be the first and last time he would meet most of this very extended family. With one of his last breaths, his generations-long facade cracked, and he admitted he wanted them not to lament over him, but to be pleasantly surprised at how young he looked. Nobody in the history of the world has looked remotely good in a hairpiece, but somebody has to be the first, right?
That's Kurt Lund.
It be knocking at my door. Go away, don't come round here no more. Can't you see that it's late at night? Night, I'm very tired and I'm not feeling right. All I wish is to be alone. Stay away, don't you invade my home.
The Smarts backing me up on a little disguise-related music that we all probably cringe at. Thanks for your indulgence. Next up on the stage of the Story Slam is Fritz Bogut. And Fritz, first of all, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. Nice to see you here.
Now, a little note about you here says, sounds more like kind of like a lapel button or a bumper sticker. Ask about Frontier Pies.
Frontier Pies was a restaurant I worked at many years ago. And it was a pioneer-themed restaurant.
You know, I've been to a Frontier Pies, believe it or not.
There may be half a dozen of them. They're out of Salt Lake.
I grew up in Missoula, Montana.
Aha, uh-huh. This was
in
Bozeman.
And they had a Frontier Pies.
You got it.
Very nice.
So you know that all the women wear gingham, and the men wear tuxedos.
What are you chalking
it up? It was always a fantasy of mine to show up in real Frontier attire and come dressed as a bear.
Fritz Bogut, thanks for being here for the Story Slam.
There was a day in high school when I had to do some public speaking, and I felt awful about it. And I was about ready to quit, and I went over to my then guitar teacher's house, and I knocked at her door, and she answered the door, and I said, I have to do this public speaking, and I'm really feeling bad about it. She said, you got to go in disguise. You never know what's going to happen in your disguise. And then she told me a story about a time that she had gone to a costume party dressed as God. What happened was she put on some jeans and she bound her breasts, put on a t-shirt, put a paper bag over her head, cut out eye holes, and went to the party. And she would find a group of people having a conversation and she would kind of lean into them and stand near them, and they would look at her, and they'd continue with their conversation, and they would look at her, and they would continue with their conversation, and eventually somebody would say, who are you supposed to be? And she wouldn't answer. She'd go to another group of conversation, and they'd be talking, and they'd look at her, talk, and look. And finally, somebody would say, are you a dude or a chick in there? And she wouldn't answer. This went on all evening, and every group did the same thing. They either said, "Who are you supposed to be?" or, "Are you a dude or a chick?" And finally, one guy got so angry with her that he actually stood up, leaned over her, and prepared to fight her. And other guys had to pry her off. He was so upset that he couldn't figure out who she was or if she was a dude or a chick.
Fritz Bogut, thanks. Oh, they're geniuses, the smarts, getting us through our disguise-themed story slam tonight. I'm Jeff Horwich. Let's get our next story slammer to the stage. Amy Salloway is with us now on the story slam. Maybe some people who recognize Amy. I've seen Amy perform, and you're extraordinary, very funny, and we're very glad to have you here.
Oh, my God, thank you.
Now... this is one of the more distinctive little blurbs I've been given from people who step on stage. Fake patient for a med school.
What is there other standardized patients here? Oh my God. Yeah! Woo!
What does a fake med school patient do?
A standardized patient is an actor or just someone unemployed who portrays practice patients for med students to practice their interviewing, history taking, and compassion skills on.
What kind of skills do you develop by being that?
The ability to give feedback about what a doctor-patient exchange is like, the ability to simulate contractions of being about to go into labor. I got to be a bipolar person having a manic episode. That was super fun.
So this qualifies
as a great way to burn calories.
So this qualifies as a training for you, in a sense,
yeah,
I suppose?
Yeah, it's
sharpen your skills.
Improv training. It is, because you have to be that patient for 8 hours a day. So if you're a woman with migraine, that's a long migraine. Yeah.
Amy Salloway, fake patient and great storyteller. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. This actually happened, I swear. This is actually a comment card that I wrote to Kowalski's supermarket. Anyone shop at Kowalski's? Yes, yes. Awesome. So if you do, you know that it's a very gourmet grocery store. And I don't go there because I need gourmet food. I don't. I go there because it's 2 inches from my apartment. So, "Dear Kowalski's Market, I am both puzzled and intrigued by the bold choice you have made to include a cabbage leaf at the bottom of your boxes of single-serving desserts to go. Or at least my serving of dessert to go. Last night, I was eating a slice of chocolate cake I had purchased from your store. I was consuming it directly out of the plastic carton, why dirty a dish, and found myself chewing on what looked, felt, and tasted like a wide ribbon of purpley-brown seaweed, or a paper-thin human liver flattened by a semi. It had wound itself tenaciously through the body and frosting of the cake so that it took some effort to extricate it and then make the diagnosis, cabbage leaf. Actually, I'm not positive that is a correct identification. I know your store specializes in exotic produce, and my exposure to anything past basic plebeian foliage is limited. Maybe I'd met with a frond of Finnish arugula, or Tibetan radicchio, or some other smug cruciferous vegetable out of my league. I guess I can't be sure. But the point is that this leaf did not enhance my chocolate cake experience and, in fact, detracted from it. I'm not sure what purpose you thought the leaf was serving, but I have come up with theories. Perhaps you intended the cabbage to be a little area rug cushioning my slice of cake from the cold, impersonal plastic floor of its boxy home. Perhaps you had meant to provide a sense of dessert theatricality, treating the to-go container as if it was the tiny set of a play. Curtain up on Act 2, Scene 1. We see Queen Titania, portrayed by Chocolate Cake, reclining regally on her mossy forest bed. "What ho, my queen," says Cobweb, played by Napkin. "Yonder cometh Puck," as my fork enters from stage right. Or maybe just maybe, you included the cabbage green on purpose as a subtle reminder that it is not, in fact, cake that I should be eating, but something more healthful. A quiet admonishment that came, alas, 12 bites too late. Whatever your purpose, Kowalski folk, I am here to tell you that while fusion cuisine might be all the rage, it does not belong in a dessert box. Your stealth cabbage leaf lying in wait interrupted the flow, the chi, if you will, of my peaceful dessert consumption and pulled me out of my zen-like sugar and carb meditation into a violent jolt of shock and confusion. I'm sure we all agree that this can't be healthy, what with the inevitable imbalance of stomach acids it creates. Thus, next time you box up your line of dessert items, could you please consider leaving the cake, the brownies, yay, even the lemon bars ungarnished? I know we live in an age of diversity and integration, but just this once, it's okay for vegetable to lie with vegetable and dessert to lie with dessert. Every now and then, separate but equal can be good. Thanks, loyal customer Amy.
Amy Salloway. That's it for this latest edition of the In the Loop Story Slam. That's the smarts behind me, Joe Weissman, Jimmy Kennedy, and Morris Engel on drums. Special help tonight from Dave Russ. Thanks a lot, Dave. Not every band can do what they do, that's for sure. Keeping up with stories in the spur of the moment. We love them for it. Thanks to Don Driggs and the Suburban World Theater. This was a pleasure to be here tonight. It's a great, great spot. Live assistance tonight from Molly Bloom, Bradley Campbell, Christina Schmidt, and Alan Freckman. Our photographer is Jeremy Pavlik. Our engineers this evening, Kyle Weslow and Cameron Wiley. The Story Slam is produced by Melissa LaCase with the assistance of Sandin Totten. Our senior producer at In the Loop is Mark Brule. NPR's director of live events, including this one, is Tony Bowl. Production of In the Loop is overseen by Leith Bishop. Our executive producer is Michael Scholar. Thanks to all our storytellers. Thanks to this wonderful audience we had here tonight. I'm Jeff Horwich. We'll see you next time in the Loop. Hello, this is Jeff again. Hope you enjoyed the Story Slam. We don't have another one scheduled just yet. Watch our website for details. We do have 6 more live tapings of our regular In the Loop shows coming up this fall. We can definitely use you in the audience. The next one is on Thursday night. We're dipping into questions of personal finance for a show called Why Am I Spending So Much? In an uncertain economy, we'll look at why most of us are big spenders, what can come of that, and we'll open up the In the Loop confessional to our audience to talk about their most shameful purchases. Beyond that, we're working on a show about bullying, not in the schoolyard, but in the real world once we grow up. As part of it, we want your songs, poems, and stories about your adult bullying experiences. Send us what you got through our website. That's also where you can get free tickets for the fall season, watch videos from past shows, subscribe to the podcast, and keep an eye on our daily blog filled with all kinds of great odds and ends. Of course, we also want you to let us know how we're doing. That's all at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop.
Broadcast of In the Loop is supported by Summit Brewing Company, local brewer of Summit Extra Pale Ale and other fine beers. More information at summitbrewing.com.